You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. And today, I'm really excited to be talking to Professor of Environmental and International History at the University of Victoria and author Jason M. Colby. He has recently written a book called Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. And so I can't think of anything more timely than to be talking to Jason today as we listen to the stories unfold about our very wonderful J-Pod and how much we love them and care about them. Maybe we are loving them too much. And I do want to mention that at the Wooden Boat Fest this year, we had an orca sail by right off Hudson Point Marina. So that was pretty exciting, too. Welcome, Jason. Thanks for talking to me today.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, let's begin right away with your own story, your personal reasons for writing this book and becoming involved with orcas in our Salish Sea.
Yeah, well, it's a really deeply personal connection, actually. My father participated in live captures of orcas on both sides of the border in the 1970s. And as a little boy in the 1980s and 1990s, I watched him wrestle with some of the pain and the guilt of that as he thought about it, and as the meaning of orcas changed in our region and they became increasingly iconic to our environment. And so I probably had this book in me my whole life, but I had needed to be in the right place in my life to be able to dig back into this history that's both a regional history about how we've transformed in our relationship to the marine environment and this iconic animal, but also a deeply personal journey of my family's role in this.
So you were born in Victoria and lived there for a while and then raised in Seattle. What other connection did you have with the world of fishermen and science?
From about the age of four, I was with my father often on fishing boats in Washington State and in Southeast Alaska, and so really my first encounters with marine life and certainly with killer whales were in the wild, and getting to know the world of fishermen certainly helped inform, I think, a lot of the way I approached this book. This is a region that was an extractive economy for its first century and a half, the Northwest, and a lot of my interest in this came out of how we've transformed from that and really began to think about animals, at least certain animals in our region, as precious beyond just the commodities they could give us.
Mm-hmm. And one thing about this book that I really enjoyed reading, because I'm very much a layperson, is the characters and the interviews that you had with people that were right there and, were the leading people in the news, the people that, were involved with SeaWorld capture and with the first captures of orcas here in our area. So that was really an exciting thing to read. And I found out that, who I thought were the bad guys, the black hats, were not really that. It's you certainly portray the people, the characters in this history, both black and white. And so tell us a little bit about what was happening in the late 50s and early 60s, and what were the attitudes towards the killer whale or the orca at that time?
Yeah, I would say you put that really well. I would say that one of the challenges of this book was to bring us back and really contextualize our relationship with orcas and to remind people that, up until the 1950s and 1960s, the debate in the Northwest, if there was a debate, the debate about killer whales was not, between whale catching and whale watching. It was between whale catching and whale killing. The primary interaction that the people in the region and around the world had with this apex marine predator was to kill it, to view it as a vermin species, a pest that ate up more valuable potential commodities, northern fur seals or salmon. And so, one of the things that really emerges, and certainly this is a story very much centered on the Northwest, what emerges is a much deeper and more troubling history of violence toward killer whales long preceding live capture. And so you have schemes to eliminate them to protect sport fisheries in BC waters. You have widespread violence among indigenous and settler fishermen to shooting them along with seals and sea lions. And the thing I also like to point out is that whale science until the 1960s was really almost entirely conducted on a kill and dissect model. So the way that killer whales were studied was when scientists went out often on whaling ships in California and such, and the only way they studied orcas was to go out and shoot them and then dissect them and see if they were eating anything valuable. And this is certainly the way that scientists at what is now the NOAA Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle, at the time, that was the only way that they studied any marine mammals, was to go out and shoot and dissect. And so I had to bring people back to an earlier. I had to bring readers back, I guess, to an earlier part of our history when we really didn't have the same relationship to orcas as we imagine ourselves having now.
No, people thought that they were just killers. That they were dangerous, and that they were eating all the seals and the otters and the salmon.
And potentially eating people. There's quite a bit of reports, never quite confirmed, but that killer whales could indeed eat people as well as other prey items. And human beings have a long history of being afraid of pointy toothed predators. It was a pretty rational fear, at the time.
Mm-hmm. Wolves and orcas. So
yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about a really fascinating person who I'd never heard of before. And I'd like you to tell us about Ted Griffin. Who was Ted Griffin?
Ted Griffin is really the central figure of the story. And he, in many ways, helps us through his story understand this transformation in our relationship to this animal. He was a boy. He was born in 1935. Grew up in the Tacoma area and was a really passionate animal lover and sort of a really adventurous young man. And in 1962, he opened Seattle's first real major aquarium on the waterfront, on Pier 56,
mm-hmm.
and it was called the Seattle Marine Aquarium.
It's still kind of
I should say that was during the Seattle World's Fair, mm-hmm. that was opened, and he had a dream from very early on to introduce kids in Seattle to the sort of magic of animals. But he also had this almost quixotic dream of potentially befriending a blackfish, a killer whale, and he tries all kinds of different means to try to make this connection, and eventually trying several different means to capture an orca alive to enable this interaction to take place.
He was really willing to give up everything for this goal. He was, obsessed, I would say, by, what he wanted to do. And so, almost by accident, Namu comes into his life. So let's talk about what happened then.
Yeah, he spends years trying to find a way to capture an orca alive in Puget Sound. And just by chance, a couple of Canadian fishermen far to the north in this little town of Namo, BC, accidentally net a couple of orcas while they're fishing, a calf and a much larger male orca. The calf eventually escapes. The other oceanariums that had been interested in buying the calf potentially decide that they're not going to be able to, move this large male. And Griffin, just really, as you say, obsessed with this quest to have this have this killer whale and to connect with this killer whale. It goes around to all the waterfront merchants in Seattle, on the piers of Seattle, and you know, asks them to loan him money, and promises to bring back this attraction that will transform the Seattle waterfront. And he actually flies up to Namu, BC, with a backpack full of small bills, hands over, you know, this money to the Canadian fishermen, and then ends up having to build a floating steel cage, and tow it all the way, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles from Namu, BC, you know, through Queen Charlotte Sound and the Inside Passage down to Seattle.
Right, because at this time there's kind of no protocol for how to move a large animal such as this. He invented all of this, and also there were no laws about international trade with about these whales. I mean, he could pretty much do whatever he wanted to, right?
Absolutely not. I mean, it is important to point out that there were no protections of any kind in the United States or Canada or anywhere else in the world for orcas, and in fact, there's no laws against shooting them. People regularly did so, and the only question that comes up is that as Griffin crosses the border, the you know, pretty comically, residents of Washington State will appreciate this. The U.S. customs officials agree to waive any customs fees, but Washington State demands sales tax on the whale, to collect sales tax on the whale.
And did he have to give him an IOU, or did he have some small bills left in his backpack?
They ended up billing him. Mm-hmm. And the other funny part is that Washington State Fisheries informed Griffin that he was not allowed to feed his whale any fish that were fit for human consumption. Mm-hmm. So even though Griffin had been feeding Namu, the whale had been named Namu in the process of this passes down, he had been feeding Namu Chinook salmon. Once he gets into Washington State waters, he's actually informed he's not allowed to. And so this whale who had lived his whole life hunting Chinook salmon has now been banned from eating Chinook salmon by the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so many other stories. What I do want you to talk about, once he has him in Seattle, he's really afraid of him too. So how does their relationship progress?
It's really difficult to remind. I mean, take people back to a moment when orcas are considered, you know, terrifying predators. I mean, there was no one that we know of in human history that had ever swam with a killer whale, and it was considered just as, if not more, dangerous than getting in the water with a great white shark. And so once he has Namu on that Seattle waterfront, you know, one of the big stories in the Seattle Times and the Seattle PI, which were covering the story obsessively, is, you know, this question of, is Griffin really going to get in the water with this whale? He says he's going to, but he can't possibly mean this. And Griffin takes, you know, a week or so, a couple weeks, and you know, tries to get up the courage to get in the water. And it's actually his brother, Tim Griffin, that sort of dares him into the water, and eventually Griffin gets in the water with Namu, and to the surprise of so many who are watching, including, you know, whale experts that are following the story elsewhere in the country, Namu, far from tearing Griffin limb from limb, you know, swims gently with him, allows Griffin to brush him and eventually touch him, and eventually they build this astonishing relationship that really captivates the attention of not just the region, but a lot of attention internationally.
You're listening to KPDZ, and we're talking to Jason Colby today on Book Lovers Cafe. Jason is the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator, published just this spring in 2018. It is such a timely book and really, really a fascinating story. It happened all right here. So let's go on with the story, Jason, and talk about just in those few years in the mid-60s, you know, what are some of the other pivotal events that happened that really switched all of our idea about what an orca was?
Well, I would say that, you know, to connect the strands of the story, you know, Griffin's relationship with Namu really, you know, excites people around the world, and, you know, he publishes a big piece in National Geographic that gains the attention of people, you know, everywhere. And he also begins the process. He's the very first to start catching and selling live orcas, which are now increasingly in demand as a potential, you know, main prime attraction for the oceanarium industry. And one of the whales that he catches just across the water from Seattle and Yukon Harbor is what I have argued is the most influential whale, the most influential cetacean in human history, and her name was Scanna. She's caught in early 1967. Griffin sells her to the Vancouver Aquarium. She's the very first whale that the Vancouver Aquarium displays for the public. And she doesn't just, gain the attention of school kids and, you know, adults all over Vancouver and people visiting, but she also really transfixes a young scientist from New Zealand there named Paul Spong. Spong had come up there to do just some pretty basic visual acuity tests on her and on the dolphins, and his relationship with her and her interaction with him really starts a process of personal transformation for him, and including, you know, several key moments where she basically refuses to run his experiments and to do his vision tests anymore. She just essentially refuses, starts answering all wrong. And this is mind-blowing.
She was a little bit of a rebel, wasn't she?
Absolutely. And this, as I say, this begins this process for Spong of not just rethinking what a killer whale is, what an orca is, but you know, his and other people's ideas of whales and of animals. And he goes on not just to become a pioneering researcher of wild killer whales, and he's still at work in northern Vancouver Island, but he goes on to help influence and inspire Greenpeace and Greenpeace's anti-whaling campaign. And that in particular, I should say that Bob Hunter, the leader of Greenpeace, comes with Spong to visit Scanna in the Vancouver Aquarium, and Scanna actually takes Hunter's head in her mouth very gently. And for Hunter, this is an epiphany, this connection with this whale. And he goes on to really be, you know, the messiah almost of the anti-whaling campaign of the 1970s. And, you know, that those encounters with Spong, with Hunter, those are encounters that were only really possible because of Scanna's captivity. I mean, those are, you know, moments that she would never have had with Spong or with Hunter. And so it helps us see, I think, the nuances, the shades of gray in the story that you know, as upsetting as captivity is for us in many ways now, that it opened up possibilities for scientists and for people that weren't there before.
Right. So that across the whole world, then this Save the Whales movement grew, and, you know, it just became bigger and bigger, and it moved out of the Northwest, and it became more than just SeaWorld. There was a lot of other things that happened to the people that were the whale catchers, the things that they just incidentally observed and discovered about the life of the orca and, you know, how they lived and communicated, that, you know, it didn't even take a scientific researcher. So talk a little bit about, you know, Pender Harbor and also the pivotal Penn Cove Roundup that everyone still talks about.
Yeah, well, I will say that that, you know, these days the research on whales and certainly research on killer whales is almost entirely decoupled from captivity, and so we tend to think about them as separate. But in many ways, you know, the modern study of orcas was initiated by captivity, in the sense that, and I always have a feeling that listeners and readers sort of scoff at that notion, but. You know, we had not confirmed, for example, that orcas use echolocation until they had observed them in close contact of captivity. Nobody knew how their diving physiology worked, how their sleep patterns worked, and so these were all. And this is, you know, true of captivity in general. These are discoveries and confirmations that were not really possible observing wild animals. So it did help transform scientists not just Spong, but you know the captors and the researchers that came to study whales like Nemu and Scana had an access that they couldn't have dreamed of before. I mean, many of these researchers had never interacted with a live whale before. It had always been carcasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the growing fondness and knowledge about killer whales that this helped promote also contributed to misgivings people had, certainly in the region, about the ongoing live captures, especially since no one knew ultimately how many killer whales were in the area, right, and whether they were, you know, a resident population or whether they were, you know, different animals that came in at different times from the outside ocean. And these sorts of concerns grew and grew, and ultimately, you know, in the late 60s and especially 1970, they crest as the number of captures and the number of whales removed or continued to grow. You know, there are three captures that take place on the Sunshine Coast in B.C., where a whole pod is essentially removed. And then the crescendo comes, the most infamous event is the Pen Cove capture, the Pen Cove roundup of 1970. And in that event, Griffin's company, the Nemu Incorporated, which is based on the Seattle waterfront, captured, unknowingly, I should emphasize, mm-hmm. captured virtually the entire population of what we now know as the southern resident orcas. Nobody knew that this was a resident population or that there were three pods or anything like that, but they captured between 80 and 90 animals.
So J, K, and L pod all captured.
J, K, and L pod, virtually all of those animals are captured in Pen Cove right off of Whidbey Island.
Mm-hmm.
And, in hindsight, it's horrifying, and mm-hmm. the videos and the sound of it really are upsetting, and there's just no way to deny that. It's worth noting that even at 1970, there were no regulations in place to limit this kind of action, or to prevent the removal of all of those animals. And so, it's worth noting that, you know, at the time, Griffin ordered the release of half of them immediately, and then takes a smaller number out for sale, but releases the vast majority of the animals,
mm-hmm.
which he was under no compulsion to do under legally. But in the course of that capture, four animals drowned, three calves and one adult female. And in a decision that really haunts him and haunts the memory of the region, I think, ever since, he and his partner, Don Goldsberry, decide to conceal the bodies of the three calves, when those bodies turn up, it really creates a really emotional backlash against the captures, and ultimately leads to regulation in Washington of the captures, not the banning, but regulation of it, and does contribute to the much larger, more sweeping Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, passed mm-hmm. by U.S. Congress.
Mm-hmm. And so this is really a turning point for Ted Griffin. And is it after this that he leaves Western Washington?
Yes, he's. It's an event that I think has haunted him his whole life. It's a memory that I think still brings back horrors to him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for him certainly there was a deep sense of obligation and you know, a sense, I think, that he, from his perspective, that he failed those whales, that he had gone in the eyes of the public, certainly from being the greatest friend of orcas, as he was seen from with his friendship with Nemu, to being the greatest threat in the Northwest. And I think that was a really deeply painful process mm-hmm. for him and for his family, and ultimately the criticism and, you know, even the threats that were directed at him, drove him into retirement.
Right. And I do want to just, you know, commend you at this point for finding Ted, talking to him, telling his story so sympathetically and evenly, and also all of the other people that that were there, that you went and talked to, and really made this book come alive much more than, you know, your basic nonfiction.
Thank you. Well, I should emphasize that, you know, it's those people's willingness to make the leap of faith to trust me with their stories and their memories and their lives, you know, the stories of their lives that made this book possible. And so it was the most meaningful piece of the research and the writing. It was also often the most painful to see the emotions and often the guilt that people were wrestling with, you know, 40 and 50 years after the fact. But it gave the book an emotional fabric and sort of a power, I think, that I wouldn't have been capable of if they hadn't been willing to open their hearts to me.
Mm-hmm. So the last big event that I wanted to talk about today was happened outside of Olympia at Bud Inlet, and it had a lot to do with what the legislature decided here in Washington State. Do you want to talk a little bit about that day?
Yeah, this is a story. I've often joked that this is an event that, you know, if I tried to sell this as a novel, no one would find it plausible because it's such an astonishing event. But, you know, this occurs in March 1976 when legislators in Olympia have actually in recent days been debating the notion of or the possibility of Puget Sound being declared a whale sanctuary. And there's, in addition, there was an orca symposium slated to be held at nearby Evergreen State College the following weekend that this happened. And on the weekend before that symposium, SeaWorld, which had bought up the Seattle Marine Aquarium and Nemo Incorporated and was now trying to catch whales in Puget Sound, makes the astonishing decision of capturing a pod of whales in Bud Inlet, literally within sight of the state capitol, the Capitol building. You know, you can see from this capture site, and even beyond that, as the capture is taking place, one of the aides to Republican Governor Dan Evans, very familiar figure to Washington State residents now, Ralph Monroe, the former Secretary of State of Washington, was out on the boat, on a sailboat, with friends when this capture takes place, and they actually try to intervene to stop the capture. And Monroe and his wife Karen Monroe immediately, you know, get in touch with reporters and start lobbying the governor and Attorney General Slade Gordon to intervene to get these whales freed. And it turns into an extraordinary legal case, the state of Washington against the U.S. government and SeaWorld, pressing for the release of these whales, and it goes all the way to federal appeals court, and it results in ultimately the end of orca captures in Washington State, and it's just an extraordinarily dramatic moment.
Mm-hmm. And so now we have, you know, their lives in Puget Sound today, and I think, you know, if you want to find out more about what's happening and think about what's happening today, if you want to learn about really the story of Lolita and the Lummi Nation, it's all here in this wonderful book by Jason Colby. It's called Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. I think everybody that lives here in Port Townsend and loves our resident whales should take a look at this book. Please join me next time to find out more about books and authors. And thank you so much, Jason, for joining me today to talk about this book.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
Okay. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and I want to thank Jacob Brown, who's here with me in the studio, and Carl Allen, who will edit this program. If you only listen to part of this program, you can hear the rest on the KPTZ podcast page at kptz.org, and there's many other programs there for you to just listen to whenever you feel like it. So join me next time, and thanks again. Bye.